A former journalist, folk singer, and attorney, Jeffrey Deaver is an international number one best-selling author. His novels have appeared on bestseller lists around the world. His books are sold in 150 countries and have been translated into over 25 languages, selling over 50 million books worldwide. The author of over 35 novels, three collections of short stories, and a nonfiction law book, as well as a lyricist of a country western album, he's received or been shortlisted for dozens of awards around the world. His latest is The Cutting Edge, where his star protagonists, Lincoln Rhyme and Amelia Sachs, discover a killer terrorizing couples in New York City. It is always a great treat to hang out with my buddy Jeffrey Deaver, and we do so this morning. Hello, sir. How are you?
Good to talk to you again.
I always look forward to our conversation. So how did this particular story come about?
When I create a Lincoln Rhyme book, this is the 14th in the Lincoln Rhyme series, but the fact is any book, I do a typical formulaic Deaver book, and there's nothing wrong with a formula, I think, and that is a book that takes place over a short period of time, maybe 2 or 3 days. The Cutting Edge is about 3 days, I think. So it's important to have a formula for a book, and we can talk about my outlining process and so forth, but suffice it to say that I've got a typical Deaver book, but I need something new, something unusual. I call it a hook. For instance, my book, The Steel Kiss, was about the dangers of smart products. Those are Wi-Fi enabled, baby monitors and security systems in cars. Burial Hour was about illegal immigration. The Cutting Edge is about the diamond industry, something I had never written about before. Now, we've all heard about blood diamonds, of course, the terrible conditions that workers in Africa have suffered as warlords and unscrupulous diamond companies have exploited the workers. And that's, you know, a horrible situation, but I didn't want to write about that. I didn't want geopolitics. I wanted something really close to home. So I created a villain named the Promiser, and by virtue of the fact that he's given a name like that, we can figure he's not such a good guy.
Right.
And he is obsessed with diamonds. He loves diamonds, and he also considers it a travesty that young married couples buy mass market diamonds that he feels have been destroyed, that they are not, they're simply a commodity. They are not treated with respect. And he targets these victims just on their happiest time of their lives. They're about to get married. They're buying their diamond ring. And he goes after them. And Lincoln and Amelia learn about this, and they get on the case and try to track him down. And frankly, if you who are familiar with my books and any of your listeners are familiar with my books, you know, this is just the start of the game. There's a lot else that happens, and not all is quite what it seems to be. But by virtue of the fact I'm a suspense writer, I have to kind of end my comments there. I don't want to give away too
much. Sure. You know, I don't know that we've ever talked about this. Giving your villain a name like the Promiser and making that villain a presence, that is very different than cops or detectives or whoever, the crime fighters, working against the unknown, which is so often a part of the genre. What is the benefit of having a very true, scary villain?
The world of crime books is divided into two basic categories. One is mystery, the other is thriller. And a mystery is a story that might have been written by, say, Agatha Christie. That's a good example. It's a whodunit. It is a question of trying to unravel the puzzle about what happened in the past. The thriller, which is what I write, always asks the question, what is going to happen? And so to help me move that story along as quickly as possible, I create a visible villain. Somebody we know, his or her identity is not a surprise, which isn't to say that in the eyes of the police, they might not know who that villain is. They still have to track him down. But we do, and it gives me the opportunity to create all kinds of murderous scenarios as we follow that villain. Now, I will say this. It's also important to give the villain some redeeming qualities. Remember that the villain is the hero of his story. And so the fellow who it's not a surprise. His name is Rostov. He's Vladimir Rostov. He's a very tough Russian fellow, but his nickname is the Promiser. And he is somebody who is truly hurt by what happens to the diamonds. And, you know, you don't want him to succeed. He's doing nasty stuff. But I think it enhances the emotional engagement of the story to see that he's somebody who is truly troubled by what he sees as a crime against these wonderful stones.
What is it about the type of thriller that you write that we as an audience love and are attracted to? Here is the Promiser who is going after people during some of the most precious moments of their lives, and yet you can't put that down. You don't not want to read it. You want to read every page and every word of it.
Well, thank you, Joe. I spend a lot of time thinking about scenarios that will grab readers immediately. The great Pulp Fiction writer, Mickey Spillane, said that people don't read books to get to the middle.
Right.
Think about it. We pick up a novel expecting the author to have the diligence and the intelligence and the wherewithal to race us through the book to get to the very end. Well, that's my model for writing. And so I look for scenarios that will allow me to do that. And there are a lot of tricks I've learned over the course of time. I'm president of the Mystery Writers of America this year, and I'm teaching a series of courses in writing commercial fiction. And part of it is crafting the plots that move the story forward very quickly. Some of that involves having several stories going on at once, cross-cutting, we'd call that in movies, and having very fast-paced scenes followed by a slow scene, which allow the readers to, you know, catch a deep breath. But then they also know there's this overarching crime that's going to happen if we don't move forward quickly. And so it's the way a car manufacturer puts together the car as best one can, the most efficient way, and that's the way I try to craft my stories.
Let us talk, this is one of my favorite topics when I'm having a discussion with you, is let us talk about the relationship between Lincoln Rhyme and Amelia Sachs. You really, I think, right, picked up right away in the first book that this is going to be something that would be an interesting, fascinating relationship between two very different people who are brought together and have a lasting, interesting, fascinating relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Amelia Sachs is the daughter of a police officer, and in fact, her roots go back even further than that. Interest in law enforcement, and she is also a very attractive woman, and she was a fashion model in New York for a few years, but rejected that. It was really a case, this is before the Me Too movement, but she was not pleased at the way she and other women were treated in that industry, this was in the 90s, and rejected it, just said, no, I don't want any part of this, and became a police officer, much to her mother's utter dismay, and that was the source of some conflict in a couple of the books. But she became a very independent and feisty police officer, at the time a patrol officer, but now is a detective. And so she meets Lincoln Rhyme, who is in a way the opposite of her. Amelia is somebody with she likes to shoot. She's a very good competitive pistol shooter. She drives fast cars. She lives on the edge. Claustrophobia is her big fear, both mental claustrophobia and physical claustrophobia. She cannot stand still or sit still for long periods of time. Lincoln is, of course, someone who sits still all the time. That doesn't bother him because he uses his mind. Now, Amelia Sachs uses her mind as well, but she is somebody who is more intuitive and has to be at the crime scene and has to be tracking down the villains. So together they form a symbiotic relationship, a yin and yang in extremes, I guess you might say. And of course they have a romantic side to them too. They are partners. And in the last book, this is giving something away to readers who have not read the first books, but they were married at the end of the burial hour and are now husband and wife.
Is that different for you? I mean, does that spice it up for you? Does that make it more interesting for you to write now? It's a whole new thing that they are a married couple.
Actually, it doesn't, because I was not going to play. I was not going to cheat. In other words, I don't need to imperil their physical lives to create suspense. I was happy to announce years ago that I'll never kill off Lincoln and Amelia. It will never happen. But there could very well be domestic problems between them. Well, I dealt with that in a book called The Steel Kiss, where it looked like she was going to go back to her boyfriend and he was going to fall into a relationship with another disabled individual. And that played out very well in the book. I liked the way it worked. That was a bit of misdirection there, so there was, well, I won't give anything away, but that was the plot I dealt with about their romance going in different directions. Well, I did that. I'm not going to do it again because that would be cheating and lazy, and so I thought, okay, we did that plot. Now time for them to get married, and they can roll up their sleeves and get back to work solving crimes, which they will do for the extended future.
So job security for them and for you, ultimately.
And you know, the important people depending on me, that is executives at American Express and MasterCard and Visa, can rest assured that I still will be creating Lincoln Rhyme for the near future.
When you, how far do you have it plotted out? I mean, do you think about, I know your intricate plotting, but do you plot it out beyond the book, the particular book you were writing on, of, oh, this is the arc I would like to take in 2, 3, 4 years?
Actually, I don't. I'm not like a Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling kind of writer, who I assume had the 7 books planned out all ahead of time. Although I can't speak to that, I'm just was making that assumption. No, I really don't. And each of my books is a standalone. I was tempted once at a book signing when a woman asked if she had to read the prior books. At the time, I think there were 10 or 12 books in the series. If she had to read the prior Lincoln Rhyme books before she could get the meaning of the latest one, I was tempted to say yes, because I picture her at the checkout counter buying the 12 books.
Sure.
I probably that wouldn't happen, and I would end up losing all the sales. So I told her that no. And it's true. You don't need to read any prior books. So I had a rough arc that they would get together at some point. I had a rough arc that the characters, some of the characters introduced in The Bone Collector, the first book, would come back, as they did in a book, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, called The Skin Collector, which was a true sequel to The Bone Collector. But you could still read either one of those separately and enjoy the experience.
And also, the arc being that nothing is going to happen to these two. You'll never kill them off, so they'll always be there for us.
Right.
The name of the new novel, The Cutting Edge. It is published by Grand Central. Jeffrey Deaver, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
Joe, thank you so much. Have a good day.
You too. Thank you. Again, Jeffrey Deaver's latest is The Cutting Edge, published by Grand Central. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.